very little ad in the paper. This is the bottom quarter of the paper. I don't know if you can see the ad. It's this little section here. Y2K, what will the new millennium bring? Send for the free booklet. What is this world coming to? And in this paper, if we get 70 responses for a quarter page ad, we figure that's fantastic. So far, we've gotten, in just a couple of days, we've gotten 80 responses on that little one, so we've been very pleased with that. We have two sheets for the handout. I presume everybody has it. Just tuck it away someplace. We won't be using it only toward the end of the talk. All right. Countdown to Y2K. I'm sure anybody here that doesn't know what Y2K means? Okay, everybody. That's half my talk gone. I don't have to worry about that part. it's a computer glitch. And if the glitch isn't fixed in the computer systems that regulate our infrastructure, our interstate electrical power grids, and the intercontinental ballistic missiles that are programmed, these aren't fixed before Y2K, before January 1st, 2000. You're going to have some problems. Well, I think up to this point, there is more serious concern about the problem. The president and the Congress seem to be assuring us that there won't be catastrophic problems, but there will be problems of a minor nature. Clinton even advises putting away a storage of foods and drinking water, for that will last for a few weeks. But there are people in the know who claim that there are going to be very, very serious problems. And of course, what's the maximum that can happen? Well, we get up January 1st, 2000, and they turn on the water. No water. And boy, it's cold around here, you know. No heat. You flush the toilet, it doesn't flush. The lights don't go on at night. The refrigerator isn't working. There's no energy to operate the trains and the trucks to transport food. And this could create food riots. Some say that tens of thousands of people will be marauding around the streets looking for homes that have a light on because they know that home has a generator there and they must have other things stored there, so they're going to go there. so that's the maximum impact. The minimum impact is that probably there will be some disruptions for a few days, in some areas perhaps a few months, but it'll be quite durable. That's the minimum. Now, probably in some areas, smaller geographical areas, there'll be some very major mishaps. But most people in the know say that the worst part isn't going to be January 1st because in the United States we're going to be prepared for that, but it's going to be the second quarter. Because even if we are for the most part prepared for it in the United States, on government levels and municipalities and providers of electricity and gas and those public services, a lot of smaller businesses will be affected. And this and the long pull will have a drain on our economy. Then Russia and other countries certainly aren't going to be ready. And because our economic dependence on them, we're liable to fill this in the long pull, say the second quarter of 2000. So there can be some rather serious economic problems later on in 2000. But the majority opinion of people in the know predict a minimal impact in this country. Well, you know, the Christian fundamentalists don't accept this. Many of them don't. And you can go on the web pages, and boy, they have some real dire forecasts of what's going to happen. Thomas Clark, who runs an internet business called Y2K Prepare, Clark says, quote, "They are going to fix it." But who's the they? Everybody says they're going to fix it, but who's fixing it? Unquote. Now this brings us to the perspective of Y2K from the perspective of Christian fundamentalists. You know, Y2K is like a lightning rod. You know, a lightning rod, it just attracts the lightning flashes. And Y2K is like a lightning rod attracting all of the millennial doomsdayers. And from the pulpits and on videotapes and Christian radio stations, boy, you hear some very, very drastic descriptions of what are going to happen. Even prominent people like Pat Robinson and doomsdayer minister Timothy LaHaye, they are giving maximum warnings for Y2K. And some of them, who are the extreme right, they say, boy, you know, under Y2K, conditions are going to get so bad that Clinton's going to declare martial law and set up a totalitarian government. So there's all sorts of predictions out there. And others feel that it's just going to lead to a massive depression that's going to lead the way for the personal Antichrist to come on the scene. But the flip side of this among fundamentalists is that the second largest denomination, fundamentalist denomination, the Assemblies of God, dismiss all of this as wild speculation. And this is also true of the mainline Christian churches. Now, the Vatican view of Y2K is very interesting. Pope John Paul has an entirely different view. He says, quote, "The year 2000 will usher in the springtime of Christianity," unquote. And he expects the Protestant churches in the year 2000 to come under the wing of Catholicism, under the Vatican's wing, and the true millennium will begin. And many fundamentalist Christians agree with him. Now, why do many fundamentalists think Christ will return in A.D. 2000? Well, it's what we call Second Advent Millennial Fever. Just because a new calendar 2000 begins, a new millennium begins, Second Advent Fever just runs wild. The same thing happened, as you know, in A.D. 1000. Oh, there's such expectations and fanaticism about when A.D. 1000 would come. The Lord was going to return, and this was going to be the end of everything. And A.D. 1000 came, and nothing happened. But, you know, the fundamentalists who feel everything's going to happen in A.D. 2000, new millennium, they're wrong, time-wise, according to their own chronology, because they believe Christ was born when? Most of them believe he was born in B.C. 2. So they're B.C. 4. So B.C. 4 plus 1,000 years equals January 1st, 1979, or 1997. I twist numbers like that. January 1st, 1997. And according to Jewish reckoning, that would be October 1996. So they've had it. Their millennium's over. Well, what are Bible students' expectations for Y2K? Well, you know, there are a few Bible students, not based on chronology, but just because the time is short, a few Bible students believe that the maximum distress chaos will happen on January 1st, 2000, and this will precipitate such a crisis that it will precipitate a totalitarian church-state system that will have to come in to bring stability out of chaos, and they feel the smiting of the Jordan will follow, and the church will be glorified, and will be into the mediatorial kingdom. Well, I hope they're right. I don't quite think so. I think there's a little more to happen prophetically yet before we get to this stage, especially in Israel. But I don't know if you stop to think of it. Entering a new millennium, AD 2000, presents Bible students with a challenge, an entirely different area. How do we explain the long lapse of time since 1914? Going into another millennium. The Lord didn't return in the 20th century, He returned in the 19th century. And here we're entering the 21st century. How do we explain this long delay? Well, we're going to give four lines of reasoning to answer the challenge of everything happening shortly after 1914. First of all, we're going to deal with a reprint article that was 5567, I believe it was 1915. And Brother also develops a line of reasoning in this article that because everything has happened so gradually in connection with the fulfillment of prophecy and all that, you came to the time in the end in 1799, and then that was the end of the 1260 days, and the 1290 days end until 1829, and then you came to the 1335 days in 1874, and then the time of trouble wasn't going, and then you had the harvest, which was an instantaneous event, but a period of time and expectation at that time of 40 years, and then this brings you to 1914. He says, well, you know, if everything happened so gradually up to this point, and this was the way the Lord was working, why do we expect everything to happen in 1914? All of a sudden, the Lord's not going to work gradually like He's been working up to this point. So Brother Russell gives two reasons in this article why he expected things to happen shortly after 1914. One is, the Scripture says He would make a short work of it. Can't beat that one. Well, we apply that to the final phase of the time of trouble, don't we? So that follows. But the main reason is, he points out in this article the parallel between the Jewish harvest and the millennial and the gospel age harvest. That the time of trouble in the Jewish harvest, he says, was 1 year, AD 69, not AD 70. AD 69 parallels 1914. So he said the Jewish polity was destroyed in 1 year. It was destroyed by AD 70. So we would expect a one-year parallel at the end of the gospel age harvest. So 1914, 1 year would be 1915. That's why he had in the volume things would probably wind up by 1915. But it was based on this one-year parallel. Well, okay, what happened? 1950 came, 15 came, and everything wasn't completed, was it? So what would be the logical thing to conclude on this article? Well, to my mind, the logical thing to conclude is follow the reasonable suggestion that he suggested before this. He said, you know, because things have taken so long, the Lord is working gradually. This is the Lord's way of working. Well, just apply that explanation now to what happened after 1914. Why should the Lord all of a sudden, you know, boom, finish everything off completely? Why wouldn't he continue to work gradually? So I think that's one answer to the challenge of why things didn't happen shortly after 1914. And you know, it's interesting to note that by the time, what time did we start on this?
Brother Ken, we have until 12:45.
Oh, okay. Well, okay, that's including the question period.
Right.
Okay. So 12:30 was the talk. Okay. Brother Russell was expecting 1914 and 1915 things to wind up. He made some remarkable statements at times. In reprint 4530, in December 15, 1909, he said, quote, whether this age ends in October 1914 or a century later, our faith and our hopes would be equally clear and logical, unquote. From 1909, if it took a century later from 1909 and then into 1914. Our hopes and our faith would still be equally clear and logical. Well, you add 100 years to 1909, you get 2009. Well, that doesn't sound too bad, does it? Another place that Brother Russell suggested 20 years, possibly 40 years, and one place in the question book he suggests 70 years. Mary Geisinger pointed, and Bill, Mary and Bill pointed this out to me a number of years ago. So, he was expecting things to wind up shortly after 1914. He did make allowance that things could last longer and a good deal longer, and this shouldn't disturb our faith. Now, were Brother Russell's credentials as a wise and faithful servant tarnished by his over-expectations concerning 1914 and 1915? Well, admittedly, things didn't wind up like he expected. But what did happen in 1914? I think that's what the brethren tend to overlook. What did happen? Fantastic things happened. One, the time of trouble did end, or rather, the times of the Gentiles did end. The time of trouble did begin in earnest. The war stage of Elijah's vision of wind, earthquake, and fire, war, revolution, and anarchy. The war stage of that time of trouble did begin. Fourth, the church-state systems who claimed to rule by the divine right of kings came to an end. Five, World War I began in 1914. It resulted in the Balfour Declaration given in 1917, promising the right to the Jews to have a state in Palestine. And six, Brother Russell, as we have seen, did warn the brethren before 1914 that everything might not wind up immediately. Now, I look on Brother Russell's expectations, what he expected to happen after 1914. I liken it to an accordion. You know, if you close an accordion, all the fins are right close together, aren't they? Well, let's say these fins represent his expectations, the things that had to be done right. Well, you know, all the fins are there. And you stretch the accordion out, and what do you have? These fins, you know, they're a lot further apart. But all the things that he predicted, all the events that he predicted that had to take place prophetically after 1914 are taking place. It's only over a longer period of time. The accordion has been stretched out, that's all. But all the fins are there. The prophetic expectations are working out. Now, I know if you never... Again, we're dealing with the credibility of Brother Russell with that wise and faithful servant. If you ever made a list of the expectations that he had based on Bible prophecy, it's phenomenal. And I'll just give you a partial list. One, he expected the increase of man's lifespan. In his day, it was 35 years old. In our day, it's 70 years. Two, he predicted automation. Three, a decrease in the working hours because of automation. And we have seen the working hours. The work day in his time was 12 hours to 15 hours. In our day, it's based on an 8-hour day. Yes, some of you work longer, but it's still based on an 8-hour day. When I worked, I worked a 7-hour day. How long ago was that? Fifth, details of the time of trouble. War, revolution, and anarchy, the three stages. The war stage did begin. The revolutionary stage, I don't mean the earthquake of Revelation 16, but the earthquake of Elijah's vision. I feel the revolutionary stage did begin in 1918, and we're even having taste of anarchy, and the anarchy stage is perhaps very close at hand. Six, he predicted that the revolutionary stage would come peacefully in the United States by ballot. And what happened in the United States and Western Europe? We had a welfare state that didn't come by violent revolution. It came peacefully by ballot, the way Brother Russell predicted that it would come. And you can take what Brother Norby used to do. The socialist platform for the presidential run in 1932, and compared with Roosevelt's democratic platform, it was the same. The welfare state came, the revolution came by ballot in the United States and Western Europe, just as Brother Russell predicted. 70 predicted the churches coming together as a scroll, and we see the ecumenical movement taking place. And 80 predicted that Babylon would come to power at the end of the revolutionary stage. Not before the revolutionary stage, but well into the revolutionary stage. I'll just give reprint references on this. I don't have time to read it. Reprint 5601, paragraph 5. Reprint 50... Can't even read my own writing. I think it's 54, paragraph 8. The revolutionary stage would be well in progress before the churches came to power. In 9, he predicted the Israel would increase in immigration of Jews to the homeland. In his day, there were less than 500,000. Today, there are over 5 million Jews in Israel. And he predicted, on the basis of prophecy from the land of the north, that Jews would migrate to from Russia in great numbers. Well, you know, he waited all the way to the 1990s for that to happen, didn't he? But it's happening. Just as Brother Russell predicted, only the accordion is stretched out. It's taking longer to happen. Okay, a third line of reasoning to show the reason for the long delay after 1914. I think the Lord revealed to us scriptures that give the reason for the long delay. I think of Brother Julius Bednarz. Back in the 90s, Julius was a precious saint to me. We roomed together for 2 years at the Dawn. He was a living saint. In the 1950s, he gave a talk on Amos, 5th chapter, 18 through 20. Communism was at its height, and he was predicting the demise, the end of communism, based on Amos 5, 18 through 20, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with. Woe unto you that desire the day of the Lord. To what is it for you? The day of the Lord is darkness and not light. Verse 19. It's as if a man fled from a lion, and a bear met him, or went into the house, and leaned his hand on the wall, and a serpent bit him. When the day of the Lord began, there was a lion. Who was the lion? It was the symbol of Great Britain. Great Britain's national symbol is a lion. And the sun never set on the British Empire. It just engulfed the world. The human race, for the most part, was under the influence, if not under the rule, of the British Empire, the lion. And in the day of the Lord, man, the human race, fled from the lion, and he met a bear, the Russian bear. And that bear just squeezed him so tight in the totalitarian government. Over one-third of the earth was communist. And Julius, on the basis of this prophecy, said that man would flee from the bear and enter the house of nationalism. And what did we see in 1989 and 1990? The collapse of the communist empire. And what happened to the Soviet republics of the Soviet Union? They became independent states, nationalism. What's happened in Yugoslavia? What's the reason for all the turmoil and the stress? Nationalism. Each ethnic group wants his own nation. Man is entering into the house of nationalism. And he puts his hand on the wall for support. And what happens? He's bit by a serpent. And we feel that that deception of the serpent of the devil will be a church-state system in this way to come. You know, Julius had a brother, Brother Walter Bednarz. He's in a veteran's home now, has Parkinson's disease. Just like Sister Vicky, he's rejoicing in the Lord. Walter was never an elder. He would never accept eldership. But he was a great student of God's Word. And back in the 1970s, in the East Coast, he would say to us elders, he'd say, look, read Isaiah 23. Something's going to happen in 1985 or 1989. Well, you're all acquainted with Isaiah 23. We'll read it again. Verses 15 through 18. And it shall come to pass that day that Tyre shall be forgotten 70 years according to the days of one king. After the end of the 70 years shall Tyre sing as a harlot. Verse 16. Take a harp, go about the city of Christendom, thou harlot that has been forgotten. Make sweet melody and sing many songs that thou mayest be remembered. And it shall come to pass after the end of 70 years that the Lord will visit Tyre, and she shall turn to her hire and shall commit fornication. And all the kingdoms of the world about the face of the earth, or upon the face of the earth, are the kingdoms that will commit fornication with her. Okay, we feel that Tyre is Christendom, Babylon, particularly papacy. We feel that this would correspond to the merchants of Revelation 18, the commercial phase of Babylon and especially papacy. But what happens here? For 70 years, papacy is going to be eclipsed by one king, and that one king was communism. And Walter said, wait. In 1985 or 1989, that 70 years is going to be over, and papacy is going to be singing like a harlot again. And sometime after that, she will commit fornication with the kings of the earth. Well, if we add the 70 years to 1914, it comes to 1985, and it's about that time that Pope John Paul started traveling around the world and singing like a harlot. And the people loved it. The rulers loved it. Time magazine said that the heads of state were eager to meet with Pope John Paul. Papacy was singing as a harlot. Well, what happened in 1989? If we date the 70 years from about 1919, when communism had the impact of the demise of papacy, we come to 1989. And boy, the communist world began to collapse at that time, didn't it? And the Pope's influence, not only that, why did the communist empire collapse? Most of you have read the Time magazine article, picture of Reagan, President Reagan, and Pope John Paul on the cover, how they secretly plotted and succeeded in the downfall of the communist empire. Can you believe that? The 70 years were up, and it was time for papacy to sing again as a harlot. Oh, this is fantastic. The Lord has given us some reason for this long delay. There was to be a 70-year period after 1914 or 1919. There was to be a experiment with communism, which we'll get into a little more. And that would have to fall before the church-state powers would come. So, you know, we're pretty much on target. Here we are in the 1990s, after the 70 years are over, and one of the next things to happen is the rise of the church-state systems. Now, the fourth reason for the long delay after 1914, and it shows one of the main purposes for the 20th century, and we dealt with this at the Columbus Convention, a few of you who were down there. You know, Brother Russell, in Volume 4, he indicts Babylon, ecclesiastically, civil, financial, and he shows that Babylon is condemned to the Lord and it has to be destroyed. Christendom is going to be destroyed. This will be the end of our present evil world. But then he has another chapter in which he deals with the proposed remedies that were being made by philosophers and the politicians to repair the social order. They saw the evils of it, and they saw that the changes had to be made, and they wanted to salvage the social order. And Brother Russell listed these proposed remedies, communism, socialism, nationalism, and he said all of these would fail. Well, we have an interesting prophecy in Micah, the 7th chapter, verses 17 through 18. I'm reading from, I believe it's the New Revised Standard. As in the days when you came out of Egypt, came out of the land of Egypt, show us marvelous things. And in Volume 4, page 556, Brother Russell applies that verse and that phrase, when you came out of Egypt, show us marvelous things. He applies that to the final phase of the time of trouble. And the marvelous thing that Israel saw was the destruction of Pharaoh and his host in the Red Sea. And he said that was a picture of the final phase of the time of trouble, the final phase of the destruction of Christendom. Then what does the next verse say? The nation shall see and be ashamed of all of their might. The nations are going to be ashamed of their power and what they did. And they shall lay their hands to their mouths. All mouths will be stopped. All proposed remedies will be tried, and they will fail. And the nations will and the leaders will be ashamed for what they have done. That will be the final effect of the time of trouble. So I submit, the purpose of the 20th century has been to give man the opportunity to try all these proposed remedies. I want to read something to you from the Christianity Today, January 11, 1999. Under the heading, The Gods That Failed. Quote, the 20th century was the age of ideology, of the great isms, communism, socialism, Nazism, liberalism, humanism, scientism. Everywhere, ideologists nursed visions of creating the ideal society by some utopian scheme, whether by revolution or racial purity or scientific technology. The true believers set out to build the modern Tower of Babel. And it goes on to say, the attitude was captured in the film Titanic, when a passenger glances proudly at the ship as he's boarding it and declares, even God himself cannot sink it. Well, they soon learned different. And he goes on to say, other idols have sunk just as surely, if not as quickly. Nazism was forever disgraced by the horrors of its concentration camps. The Soviet Union crumbled with the Berlin Wall. Around the globe, formerly socialist nations are eagerly lining up to establish free economies. Liberalism, while still powerful, has lost its luster. American politicians askew the label. Even science often seems the Frankenstein monster turning on its creators. This is the most significant fact. At the end of the 20th century, all the major ideological constructions have failed, tossed on the ash heap of history. As a result of all the proposed remedies being tried in the 20th century, all mouths are being stopped. There is no remedy. And this has been the reason for the 20th century. One of the main reasons for this long delay after 1914. But you say, Ken, wasn't the purpose of the times of the Gentiles to try out every conceivable type of government and way of ruling to bring about man's utopia? Well, I think many of us have thought the way, or used to think that way, but I'm not so sure the main purpose of the times of the Gentiles was to try every type of government. You know, we have an interesting statement in Daniel 4, verses 16 and 17, when it's dealing with the times of the Gentiles. Verse 16 deals with the seven times that Nebuchadnezzar is turned into the beast. Let his heart be changed from man's, and let a beast's heart be given unto him. Let seven times pass over him. In verse 17, this matter is by the decree of the watchers, and the demand by the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living may know. That the living may know what during the times of the Gentiles? That the living may know the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth over it the bases of men. During the times of the Gentiles, God is going to set over the kingdoms the bases of men. They're not going to be trying every type of government. There's not going to be any idealism there. And there wasn't any idealism. So it doesn't mean that God said, okay, in England now, who's the base person? I'll put him at the head of the government. Now in France, who's the most base person? I'll put him at the head of the government. No. God knew that without his intervening, without his giving an influence of righteousness and truth and justice, that the times of the Gentiles, without this outside influence of truth and righteousness and justice, that in this imperfect society, what would happen? The basest elements automatically would rise to the surface. But the Lord returned in 1874. The Jubilee trumpet sounded. By 1914, when the times of the Gentiles came to an end, as a result of the Jubilee trumpet, men were being influenced by noble ideals, truth, equity, justice for all, freedom, liberty. And they developed all sorts of proposed remedies to man's ills. And it was after 1914 that the Lord, because of the influence of truth in their thinking, he let them try these proposed remedies that had a great deal of justice and truth in them. But they failed. Why? The Lord wanted to teach the lesson that no matter how noble the ideology and the philosophy behind government, it just won't work because man's heart is selfish. Now take away, divorce the revolution aspect of communism. That ideal is based on justice, equality. But what happened? Now, according to Marx, there would come the revolution, you need a totalitarian state to bring stability out of chaos, and then after you had the stability, the state would wither, and man would live in freedom and equity. The rulers were so selfish, they weren't going to let that state wither, were they? They wanted to rule. So this is what has been happening since 1914. And all the remedies have been tried. There's only one more that's going to be tried. It's not a new one. They're going to say, let's do it again. And that's papacy coming to power again. All right. Because of the long delay since 1914, some Bible students down through the 20th century have lost sight of the doctrine of the presence. The presence of Christ. Some today are denying the presence of Christ. And you know the difference between the denial of the presence today among Bible students and say the denial of presence of Christ back in the 20s or 30s and the 40s and the 50s? They still believed in a future invisible presence. But now the brethren who deny the presence of Christ say the Lord is going to return in the flesh when he does return. Okay. This is where we come to our handouts. Proofs of Christ's presence. And I think, well, first of all, before we deal with what I think are the three strongest proofs of Christ's presence, the one handout on the bright shining. Now, there are some Bible students who no longer believe that the Lord is present. They say, Brother Russell's view on Matthew 24, for as the lightning cometh out of the east and shineth unto the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man, or so shall the parousia of the Son of Man be. That's not scriptural. They say, look up that word, lightning. It's the Greek word astrapi. Oh, yes. It's once it's used to denote the burning of a candle. And we notice here, you know, astrapi is a Strong's 796, and you have a list from the New Englishman Concordance of all the times that astrapi is used. Most of the times it's used, it's in connection for described with Revelation 4, 5, and onward. Proceed with lightnings and thunders. Revelation 8, 5, thunders and lightnings. Revelation 11, 19, there are thunder, lightnings, and voices. Revelation 16, 18, voices and thunders and lightnings. They say, see? So the rest is dead wrong. It is lightning. It's not the sun coming from the east to the west gradually. Well, this is one of the beautiful things about comparing the gospel accounts. And just like what we did on the last week of Jesus, getting all of the details of the gospel accounts on a given subject. Well, let's take the Luke account of the bright shining. Luke 17:24. For as the lightning that lighteneth out of one part of the heaven, under heaven, shineth unto the other part under heaven, so shall the Son of Man be in his day. Okay, here you have three words. You have astrapi, lightning, but then you have the Greek word lighteth, and the Greek word lighteth is Strong 797, which is astrapo, and it also means bright shining, and it's the verb form of astrapi. The astrapi is the noun, and astrapo is the verb form, and it's just used twice. And the second time it's used in the New Testament is in Luke 24:4. It refers to the angels who had shining garments. Not that there were lightning flashes coming out of the angels, but the angels by the tomb had shining garments. Okay, but then you have a third word. This lightning that lighteneth out of one part of heaven, it shineth unto another part of the heaven. And the word, Greek word for shineth is lampo. And what does lampo mean? Here's all the times it's used in the New Testament. And every time that lampo is used, it has the thought of a bright shining. It never has the thought of lightning. So when we compare Luke 17:24 with Matthew 24:27, we have to come to the conclusion that it's not referring to lightning. It is referring to a bright shining that shines from the east to the west. And we know the sun is the only bright shining that shines from the east to the west gradually. And another interesting thing here, Matthew 24:27, so shall the parousia of the Son of Man come. But how is that exact phrase used or rendered in Luke 27:24? So shall the Son of Man be in his day. When the Son of Man be in his day, well, if it's his day, he's present, isn't it? So that means parousia, the parallel passage in Matthew 24:27, also shall the parousia of the Son of Man be. That means the days of the Son of Man when he's present. Okay, we'll put that one aside. Now, there's many proofs of the Lord's presence. I just want to deal with what I consider the, to me, the three strongest proofs of the Lord's presence. One is the definition of the Greek word parousia. Is it presence or coming? And on the second handout, 1A gives all the Bible dictionaries and Greek lexicons that define parousia as presence. And you know, all the scholars will agree that it means presence. What they do, if they're dealing with the subject of the Second Advent and they're writing on it, they'll agree that the word means presence, and about three paragraphs later, they pull a sleight of hand and they start using the word coming, after they agree that the word means presence. Okay, our second definition of the word parousia is Bible usage. That's B. We have two examples of that. We had one example of it in The Bright Shining. And our second example is Matthew 24:37, which you're well acquainted with. But as in the days of Noah, but as the days of Noah were, so shall also the parousia of the Son of Man be. Okay, the parallel accounts in Luke 17:26. As it was in the days of Noah, so shall be in the days of the Son of Man. In the days of the Son of Man is equal to in Luke 17:26. In the days of the Son of Man is equal to, so shall the parousia of the Son of Man be, in Luke 24:37, and that means in the days of the Son of Man. Parousia means in the days of the Son of Man. Just as Noah was present in his day, so the Lord will be present in his day. I am going over this very fast because you're well acquainted with it already. Then C is during the 1st century B.C. through the 3rd century B.C., you can get quotes out of Greek literature that consistently use the word parousia to denote presence. Then I have at the bottom other proofs. And I think this is one of the strongest, our second strongest point in proving that the Lord is present. Now, our non-present brethren today, as I said, believe that the Lord will return in the flesh, and that when he returns, all of the dead saints, those that died in Christ, and all the living saints will be taken immediately to heaven. That's the rapture. So when he returns, there's not going to be any of the church on the earth, any little flock or great company. They're all going to be raptured. As soon as he's coming down from heaven, they're caught up in the air with him. No church on earth. All right, now if we can find scriptures that show that when the Lord is present, members of the church are still on the earth, what does that do to their theory? It destroys it. And there are many scriptures under A here that show that the Lord's people, some of the Lord's people are still on the earth when he returns. And if we find scriptures like that, it shows that the Lord can be present, even though the church is this side of the veil. They say, oh, the Lord can't be present now because the church is caught up before he comes to the earth bodily. We won't take time to read these scriptures. By the way, we have some crossed out here. These aren't as clear, so don't even bother with them, but read the other scriptures that we have underlined here, and they prove that the church is here on the earth yet when the Lord returns. So that it proves that the Lord can be here even though the church is yet on the earth. Okay, the third, and I consider the strongest proof that we have that the Lord is present. It's not on the sheet, but it's a comparison of 1 Thessalonians 5:2 with 2 Peter 3:10. They're very similar scriptures. In the English, they're exactly the same. Now remember, Bible students will agree with us who don't believe in the presence, and our born-again Christians who don't believe in the presence, they will agree that Christ comes like a thief. Oh, yes, he comes like a thief. He comes unaware. That's why you have to watch. You don't know when he's coming. So you have to watch because he will come unawares. But where they disagree with us, they say, oh, he's not present as a thief. He's not unawares to anybody when he's present. Everybody's going to see him. Every eye will see him. So they say that the thief aspect of his coming is not that he's here as a thief, but he comes unaware, just like a thief comes enters a house unaware. You might hear him afterwards and chase him out, but he enters the house unawares. Well, 1 Thessalonians 5:2. For yourself know perfectly that the day of the Lord so cometh as a thief in the night. Now say, that's it. His coming is unawares. That's what 1 Thessalonians 5:2 says. He comes as a thief in the night. The word there is in parousia. He comes as a thief in the night. He comes unaware. You say, okay, we got you on that one. Well, let's turn to 2 Peter 3:10. But as the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in the which the heavens shall pass away, and etc., etc., etc. The Greek word there is hekel. What does the Greek word hekel mean? Has come or is here. So here, Peter is telling us that the day of the Lord will be here as a thief in the night. It will be here unawares. He will be present. And the world will not be aware of it. They'll say, now wait a minute. Hekel at the best means arrival. Well, we disagree with that, but let him have it, arrival. If he arrives, he's on earth, isn't he? Every eye's seen him. He can't have arrived as a thief because every eye will see him when he arrives, according to their theory. But the word means more than arrival. Even if it just means arrival, that they're out. Because he will arrive, when he arrives here, unawares, he will be here before, as a thief rather. But the word literally means is come. And this scripture teaches that the Lord will be here as a thief in the night. The heavens and the earth will be in the process of destruction, and the world won't realize that he's here. His presence is unawares. His presence is thief-like. Therefore, he does not return in the flesh. Because as he returns in the flesh, his presence cannot be unawares. Everyone will see him. Okay, we wanted to deal with the real millennium begun. Sure, we're going to enter into a new millennium. That's just a calendar millennium. But brethren, we all believe, well, I hope we all believe, the millennium has begun. We are in the new millennium, God's millennium, the seventh 1,000-year day since the fall of Adam. And we've been in this new millennium since 1878 or 1874. 2 Peter 3, remember we don't have time to read it, but 3 verses 17, or rather verses 7 through 12, 3 days are mentioned. The day of judgment, the day of the Lord, the day of God. And what happens on each of these three days? The heavens and the earth are destroyed. And right sandwiched in between these 3 days, Peter says, now remember, brethren, a day with the Lord is what? Is 1,000 years. So each one of these 3 days, the day of judgment, the day of the Lord, the day of God, is 1,000 years long. Now the same thing happens on each day, doesn't it? So they all must be referring to the same day, only different names to the same day. And that same day is 1,000 years long. And the heavens and the earth are destroyed. The time of trouble is a part of the 1,000-year day of the Lord. The time of trouble is a part of the millennium. So if we're in the time of trouble, we know what? We know the millennium has begun. Okay, verse 10 says, what comes as a thief in the night? But usually Bible students say, the Lord comes as a thief in the night. Which is right. What comes as a thief in the night? The Lord or the day of the Lord? They both come as a thief in the night. Some scriptures speak of the Lord coming as a thief in the night. And other scriptures speak of the day of the Lord coming as a thief in the night. Well, they must have referred to the same event, don't they? So when the Lord comes as a thief in the night, the millennium, the day of the Lord, must have begun when he came as a thief in the night. So we can have the Lord returning in 1878 and the millennium sometime way in the future. No. The day of the Lord, the millennium of the Lord, is here as a thief in the night when the thief returns. And the thief returned in 1874, therefore the millennium began in 1874. Revelation 20:1-3 deals with binding of Satan. It says an angel shall come down from where? From heaven. And lay his hands on that old serpent, the dragon, and bind him with a chain. Okay, if the binding process hasn't begun, here's 1878 when our Lord returned. But the binding process is sometime in the future yet. Hasn't begun in any sense of the word. We ask the question, how many second advents are there? We all believe that there was a second advent in 1878, right? Chronology brings us to that point. But here Revelation 21 says, the angel comes down from heaven and he binds that old serpent. So if that is yet in the future, that the serpent hasn't been bound in any sense of the word, then there's a second advent. Now there's two second advents. How many times has the Lord returned? Everybody, Bible students agree, who believe in the present, they agree, Revelation 18, that an angel comes down from heaven and enlightens the earth, and he gives a message that Babylon has fallen. No, that readily refers to the second advent. Well, verse 20 is in the future, or rather, Revelation 20 verse 1 is in the future when the angel comes down. That's a further second advent. It just doesn't fit. They all refer to the second advent and works that began when the Lord returned. We wanted to get to the 1,000 years millennium and how we live and reign with Christ 1,000 years, but we're out of time. If you want to ask that as a question, all well and good. Brethren, have faith in the accordion. All the fins are there. Sure, there's a long delay after 1914. It's just taking longer. But all the truth expectations that Brother Russell had are coming to pass. Don't lose sight of the vision. It will tarry. But though it tarry, it will not lie. The vision of present truth that we receive is true. And may God bless you with a clear vision of that plan of the ages. All right, any questions? Ruth.
Review how we live in the name of Christ.
Okay, let's have your question too. Pardon? You'll go along with that one. Okay, let's turn to Revelation 20, verses 4 and 6. Verse 4, I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given to them, and I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for Christ, for the witness of Jesus, and for the word of God, and which had not worshipped the beast, neither his image, neither had received his mark upon their foreheads in their hands, and they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. Okay, two things with this phrase. They lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. You'll see that most of the modern translation says they came to life and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. Scholars agree that the meaning here is not that they lived, but they came to life. This is referring to the first resurrection. From 1870 down, the dead in Christ were raised, and the living in Christ are gradually changed in a moment to the twinkling of an eye. And they came to life and reigned just not substitute, but put a synonym for 1,000 years in there, and it's the word millennium. What does millennium mean? 1,000 years. They came to life and reigned with Christ a millennium. A name of what?
It's a name of this age. Just like the Gospel age is a name of this age, and the Jewish age is a name of this age, millennium is another name for this age. And all John the Revelator is telling us is that they come to life and they live, or rather they reign in this millennial age. We don't have to take the word thousand here as descriptive of an exact period of time, but nearly the name of an age.
All right, verse 6. Okay, verse 5. But the rest of the dead lived not again until the 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection. One way we know that the rest of the dead lived not again until the 1,000 years are finished. One way we know it's spurious, even though it doesn't appear, and what makes it logically spurious is, he's saying this is the first resurrection. Well, the rest of the dead coming to life after the 1,000 years, that can't be the first resurrection, can it? But you take that phrase out, and what do you have? The ending of verse 4. And they came to life and reigned with Christ a millennium. This is the first resurrection. So what is the emphasis of John here? That this is when the resurrection takes place. That's what the emphasis is. Okay, verse 6. Blessed and holy is he that hath part in the first resurrection. On such second death hath no power, but they shall be priests of God and of Christ.